Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, November 27, 2020. A Sudanese minister tests positive for COVID-19.
We have no available resources to accommodate 2% of the citizens of Khartoum and even in Sudan. So keep yourself care and be careful.
And the rebels loyal to Abdulaziz Al-Hilo criticize the transitional government in Sudan for putting roadblocks on the road to peace.
They concluded agreement with other SRF because that agreement does not address the root causes of the problem. So it was quite easier. We mean by the root causes of the Sudan conflict is relation between religion and the state.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudanese health officials say nearly 20 staff in the office of the Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok tested positive for COVID-19 during a random routine sample collection. The Minister for Cabinet Affairs is among those tested positive. Health officials are asking Sudanese to follow World Health Organization's guidelines to avoid contracting the disease during the second wave of COVID-19 infections. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese health officials say the routine sample collection from the staff of the Council of Ministers resulted into 19 positive cases, which included Ambassador Omar Manis, the Cabinet Affairs Minister. In a statement issued last evening, the Minister of Health said those who tested positive include Dalia Ruby, media advisor at the Prime Minister's office, Mahmoud Hussein, financial and administrative affairs officer at the Prime Minister's office, and Yusuf Al-Bashir, director of the Minister of Cabinet Affairs office, and 16 other Council of Ministers employees. The ministry says Prime Minister Hamdok tested negative, but the staff went into self-isolation as they are monitored by the health personnel. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus today, Dr. Muhyiddin Hassan, a member of the Isolation Command Center in Khartoum State, calls the second wave of the pandemic terrifying as the infection rate continues to rise. Dr. Hassan says more than 10 medical centers in Khartoum are still facing many challenges.
We have a problem with the number of oxygen cylinders. We have a gap of around 1,110 of oxygen cylinders. This is one of the main factors preventing us to expand the services in the hospital, either primary or secondary.
Dr. Hassan says another major inhibiting factor is not enough medical staff to handle all the COVID-19 cases. He calls the second wave unfortunate as the country is facing other economic and political transition challenges. Dr. Hassan says citizens need to strictly observe all preventive measures to stop the spread of the virus.
We have no available resources to accommodate 2% of the citizens in Khartoum and even in Sudan. So keep yourself safe and be careful. Take your precautions, social distance, mask, and try to avoid unnecessary gathering in a crowded area.
Late last week, Sudan's acting Minister of Health said the government has yet to decide or whether to order a total lockdown. But Hassan says if the infection rate continues at the same rate as today, the minister might make that call to save lives.
Unfortunately, right now, we may need to revise our stuff. This rising in the situation, I think, may end the lockdown. If no more treatment centers open, no more education and awareness, if they are still careless about this situation, the denial is still about the corona, unfortunately, I think we will end this.
Sudanese former Prime Minister Sadiq Al-Mahdi died yesterday in the UAE where he was being treated for COVID-19. Al-Mahdi was laid to rest this morning in Omdurman, west of Khartoum. Sources from the family of Al-Mahdi says the former prime minister's father-in-law, known by his single name Sharif, also succumbed to disease last evening in Khartoum. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Rebels of the SPLM North, loyal to Abdulaziz Al-Hilo, are criticizing a by-law drafted recently to regulate the work of a new body created to oversee the implementation of the comprehensive peace agreement signed between the Sudanese Sovereign Council and various armed groups. A spokesperson of the SPLM North Abdulaziz faction says the by-laws will hinder his group from realizing its aspirations for the country. For VOA News, Onen Walter Solomon reports from Juba.
Following the signing of the recent peace agreement in Juba between the transitional government and various armed groups, the parties to the agreement proposed to form a council of partners for the transitional period. The council would coordinate positions of the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition, the military, and the Sudanese Revolutionary Front, a coalition of armed groups. The government has drafted a by-law to regulate the work of the council with a view toward discussing major political issues during the transitional period. Kuku Jagdol, a spokesperson of the SPLM North faction that did not sign the peace agreement, told journalists in Juba Tuesday that the by-law indicates the government has deviated from its promise to respond to the aspirations of the SPLM North and others who demanded freedom, peace and justice during the 2019 revolution.
According to the provisions of the bylaw, we find that it aims at the following article 10, 11. 1. Blocking the way to negotiation with the Sudan People Liberation Movement North that discuss root causes of the Sudanese problem appending SPLM North to the Juba Peace Agreement signed on October 3, 2020, Article 3C, weakening the Council of Ministers, hijacking its powers, turning it into a defunct body, making it into an ambiguous constitutional entity that has no role.
Jamal Malik Ahmed, the Church of Affairs at the Sudan's embassy in Juba, denies that the by-law is intended to block any future negotiations with the SPLM North Abdulaziz Al-Hilo faction or any other holdout groups.
These bylaws is not meant to make any blockage for any peace seekers, whether from SPLM North or SPLA Abdul Wahid. And we have announced this earlier, even during the signing of the peace agreement in October 3rd, that we are ready and we want to have all the parties to come and sign the peace agreement.
Jagdol also says the by-law aims to legalize a new authority which emerged from what he calls the coup d'etat of April 11, 2019. He accuses the transitional government of hijacking the revolution and trying to preserve old Sudanese laws that restrict freedom. Amar Amum Daldum, Secretary General of the SPLM North, says while his group is still committed to negotiations with the hope of agreeing on a declaration of principles, the silence coming from Khartoum makes the SPLM North skeptical about the government's intentions.
They concluded agreement with other SRF because that agreement does not address the root causes of the problem. So it was quite easier. We mean by the root causes of the Sudan conflict is relation between religion and the state and national cultural identity, which is based solely on Islamo-Arabism. So this silence from Khartoum government feed on our suspicions.
Malik says the government is waiting for communication from the South Sudanese mediators regarding the resumption of talks with holdout groups in Juba.
The government of Sudan is not silent. We did not say we are not coming. We have come to Juba based on the preparations of the mediation of the government of South Sudan. So once the mediation announced this officially and they send invitations to the government, I don't see any problem that for the government delegation to come and have peace talks with SPLM North.
Early last month, South Sudan's chief mediator at the talks, Tut Galok Kerr, told reporters that the Sudanese government and the SPLM North would resume peace talks the third week of November, which has yet to happen. Amum says the mediator told his group to await further communications regarding the next step. Malik says Galwak returned to Juba from Khartoum yesterday. He says he hopes a date would be announced soon for the resumption of the peace talks. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon reporting from Juba.
Still in Juba, police officers undergoing training at Rambur in central Equatorial State are complaining about harsh living conditions at the center. Brigadier Samuel Tok says seven officers have lost their lives in the past 6 months due to poor living conditions, including inadequate food and lack of medical care. The Rambur Center is hosting more than 300 unified police trainees selected from SPLAIO, SSPDF, and South Sudan Opposition Alliance. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
The trainees who started training in January are made up of ex-combatants from the SPLAIO, South Sudan Opposition Alliance, and South Sudan People's Defense Forces. Some trainees at Rambur Unified Police Training Center insist their lives are at risk because they have nothing to eat and have no access to medical care. Brigadier General Samuel Thok alleges that seven trainees have died at the center since May.
They were dying because of lack of treatment. There is no drug in the training center, and there is also lack of food. If there is no graduation, let them provide us food and drugs that can sustain our life in the training center. Because staying here without drug and food, it is not good.
Tok says when he and his colleagues registered for training in January, there were 320 men and women ready to serve the nation in different departments of the organized forces. He says the number has dwindled markedly since that time, and some have abandoned their training.
Some of our colleagues leave the training center because of the situation. They went to the nearby family, and the rest are here in the training, waiting for graduation.
Brigadier General Dianku Nunu, a female at the training center, says conditions are even more grueling for women.
We came here since January and now completed 11 months here. We are facing a lot of challenges here, especially for us women. We lack soaps, sanitary pads, and underwear. We are suffering a lot. We don't know what the government is doing.
Major General Charles Tai Gitwai, interim chairman of the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMEC, says his organization is concerned about living conditions at the training centers and has called on the unity government to provide more funding.
The situation in both training centers and the cantonment sites continues to be of serious concern, with more recent reports indicating that food, medicines and other essential resources remain in scarce supply, resulting in some ex-combatants abandoning cantonment sites and training centers.
Gitwai is urging the government to provide adequate funding and to speed up transitional security arrangements. Brigadier General Santo Domich, a spokesperson of the South Sudan's People's Defense Force, says a committee tasked with providing the necessary logistics to training centers has faced challenges.
The JTSC, that's the Joint Transition Security Committee, is working hard to ensure that the necessary logistics is sent to the site so that the process for graduation are met. There are some minor challenges that are being faced by this mechanism, but they are now they have taken it as a priority and they wanted to see into it that within some few days, then three positions of necessary logistics is done.
Security reforms provisions in the revitalized peace deal stipulate that the parties form an 83,000-strong unified force comprised of military, police, prison wardens, wildlife rangers, and the fire brigade. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, how are people living with HIV/AIDS and COVID-19, surviving during the pandemic. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what kinds of infrastructure improvements are the biggest priority in your community?
I would like my roads to be improved because we are not comfortable with the roads.
I think it is hospital. It's hospital because I'm seeing people suffering with their kids, even mothers, they are suffering when they are pregnant.
Park where children can play and where adults can also meet to hang out will be a big improvement.
For the government to do the street so that when people are driving, their cars cannot be bumping and all over. And the gutters as well. The gutters are full of rubbish and then it's choke as well. If they can clear the dirty things out, it will be perfect.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. During this pandemic, the World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say if you have a fever, a cough, or have trouble breathing, you should stay home and contact a healthcare facility. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest health news.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The UN Program on HIV and AIDS warns stigma and discrimination against marginalized populations are driving both AIDS crisis and COVID-19 and must be tackled and eliminated to end what officials call dual colliding pandemic. In a report released in advance of World AIDS Day on December 1st, the UN agency calls on governments to put the most vulnerable at the center of their pandemic responses. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
It is nearly 40 years since HIV/AIDS emerged. While progress in the treatment of the disease has been made, AIDS remains a public health menace. Last year, UNAIDS reported 1.7 million people were infected with HIV and 690,000 died. Health officials report the global response to ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 was off track even before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. The rapid spread of coronavirus, they say, is creating additional setbacks. Part of UNAIDS' new strategy for tackling AIDS is to direct money to the people most at risk. Yet Minister for Foreign Trade and Development Cooperation in the Netherlands, Sigrid Kaag, says that is not happening. She notes a study commissioned by the Netherlands finds only 2% of AIDS funding worldwide targets those who are most at risk.
62% of new HIV infections are among gay men, sex workers, drug users, and transgender people. How can we end the HIV pandemic, or any pandemic for that matter, if we ignore those most at risk? Stigma and criminalization impede access to medical services. And this is exactly how pandemics continue to spread.
East and Southern Africa is the region most heavily affected by HIV. The region is home to nearly 21 million out of the 38 million people living with HIV worldwide. It notes 12 million are not receiving treatment for their illness. Yet even under these circumstances, countries such as Eswatini and Botswana in sub-Saharan Africa, Cambodia and Thailand in Asia have made remarkable progress in tackling the deadly disease by implementing people-centered policies. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima says governments must focus on helping the most vulnerable, marginalized people. She says they must target preventive measures, sexual, reproductive, and other health services toward them, and not just implement policies that are politically palatable.
We're going to have to be more focusing on the hotspots
not choosing what we want to address because that's what we are comfortable with, but being evidence-based, targeting closely where the risk is, not where we don't want to see.
Bianyima says governments also must focus on reducing the inequalities that are the drivers of HIV and COVID-19. She says more investment must be made in strengthening health systems and providing treatment and care to all in need. She says respecting the human rights of people most at risk is crucial in beating back the twin pandemics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There has been more than 6.4 million reported cases of COVID-19 around the world, with 1.4 million deaths. In Germany, 15,000 people have died from the novel coronavirus. Chancellor Angela Merkel has urged Germans to remain patient with restrictions meant to slow the spread of COVID-19, while in Britain, many will continue to face tight restrictions in the weeks to follow its lifting of precautionary measures. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers reports.
Germany embarked on a so-called wavebreaker shutdown on November the 2nd, closing restaurants, bars, sports and leisure facilities, but leaving schools, shops and hair salons open. It was initially slated to last 4 weeks, but Merkel and the country's 16 state governors agreed to extend it through to December 20th to try to push down the regional infection rates. Germany, which has 83 million people, was credited with a relatively good performance in the first phase of the pandemic and still has a lower death rate than several other European countries. UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock urged English citizens to stick to the rules.
To keep people safe. And to keep the gains that are being made, more areas than before will be in the top two tiers. This is necessary to protect our NHS and keep the virus under control.
More than half of England's 56 million people, including London's 8.6 million residents, are in the middle level, where most shops, restaurants and leisure businesses can open with some restrictions. Another 23 million people in a huge chunk of central and northern England will be placed in the top tier. Under these, the toughest rules, pubs and restaurants can only serve takeout and delivery, and leisure venues such as cinemas and bowling alleys must stay closed. Karen Chalmers, London.
Friday, the day after Thanksgiving in the United States, kicks off the official holiday shopping season. One American shopping tradition is for stores to have displays featuring Santa, where children can sit on his lap and share their wishes with the golly old Eve. Despite a raging pandemic, some mall owners in America are going ahead with plans to bring Santa back to this year. But as Mariama Diallo reports, visitors will see a lot of precautions.
Malls and retail stores are doing all they can to bring back jolly old Santa and to keep the families who meet him safe from the coronavirus. This year, Santa must wear a face shield and there is no sitting on his lap. Moms say they're still happy to make the trip.
Even though we're in a pandemic, it's important that the kids are still able to be kids and still keep up with the regular traditions.
It was good that we got to see him in person, even if they couldn't sit on his lap.
A Barbie doll.
A unicorn.
An acrylic barrier provides an extra layer of protection, but it sometimes makes it hard to hear each other, says Don Lemmy, one of the Santas.
The experience this year obviously is going to be the glass in front of the harder of hearing for wishes from the children, which are normally soft-spoken to start with. But everybody here seems to be doing a good job as far as keeping their social distancing and respecting everybody's health.
The barrier, which gets cleaned between visits by Santa's helper, is glare-free, so the keepsake picture comes without the camera's flash.
It was the best time I ever had.
I mean, Santa's going to come and get us me a lot of presents.
Yeah, he is.
Loretta Mercado, a chain store general manager, says the company couldn't go without Santa this year, but it had to be done in a safe manner.
It was very important that we had all the safety features in place, all the social distancing, temperature taking, you know, the wonderful things we have to offer between, you know, Santa Wonderland's shield here and the cleaning that we do here between each and every guest.
But not everybody has opted to bring back the tradition. Macy's canceled its in-person visits this year, saying it couldn't provide a safe environment for the more than a quarter million people who normally come to see Santa at its New York flagship store. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. 19 staff members in the office of Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, including the Cabinet Affairs Minister, Ambassador Omar Manis, have tested positive for COVID-19 during a second random sampling. The Ministry of Health said those who tested positive also include Dalia Al-Ruby, media advisor at the Prime Minister's office, Mahmoud Hussein, financial and administrative affairs officer, and Yusuf Al-Bashir, director of the Minister of Cabinet Affairs. The ministry says Prime Minister Hamdok tested negative, but his staff went into isolation and are being monitored by health personnel. Dr. Muhideen Hassan, a member of the Isolation Command Center in Khartoum State, is calling the second wave of the pandemic terrifying. A Sudanese holdout group says a recently proposed bylaw aimed at regulating the work of a panel created to oversee implementation of the Sudan peace deal deviates from the agreement. A spokesman for the SPLM North faction led by Abdallah Aziz Al-Hilu says the bylaw would block his group from its goal of transforming Sudan into a democratic nation. A Sudanese embassy official in Juba says the group's characterization of the proposed bylaw is inaccurate. After the peace deal was signed in Juba, the parties agreed to form a council of partners, which would coordinate positions of the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition, the military, and a coalition of armed groups. And finally, police officers being trained at the Rambur Unified Police Training Center in central Equatoria State are decrying living conditions at the center. One brigadier general at the center claims seven officers have died in the past 6 months because there is not enough food or medical care. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's all we prepared for you this Friday. We would like to welcome our listeners on 97.5 FM Radio Sawa in Khartoum. We now leave you with the song Zunjia by Ahmed Brema.
Zunjia, ya nab al hana. Sudan ya azunji ya haram haram ya azunji ya azunji ya ya naba al hanan azunji ya وبيت السودان يا الزونجية حرام حرام يا الزونجية
We've been listening to Ahmed Brema with the song Zunjia. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and remember to wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.
السلام السلام يا الزهنية.